From the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G Scott and Ursula Voitine.
Good morning, happy Friday, and happy Valentine's Day. I'm thankful that it's Friday, and I'm thankful that Felix Bunnell is here. G. Scott is still out. He's going to be out on Monday as well. We do have a wonderful show coming up. You do not want to miss our 10 o'clock hour when we do our Ask Me Anything interview. We're going to be introducing you to two bail enforcement officers. G and I were calling them bounty hunters. They said, no, we like the title bail enforcement officer better. They say the system's so broken, criminals are laughing out loud in the courtrooms because they know they're not going to be held accountable. We're also going to have headlines for you in just a moment. Should it be a felony to give someone HIV? And should transgender athletes be able to compete against high school girls? Now, let's get on with the show. It is a story that just continues to dominate the headlines, and it's the safety in downtown Seattle, or the lack of it. Do you feel safe in downtown? If you don't have to work there, do you still visit? Yesterday, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan met with business leaders to commit to making downtown safer. Before we kind of launch into this, Felix, how often do you go downtown, and do you feel safe?
I go downtown all the time and have been doing that my entire life. It's definitely different. I feel safe most of the time. I mean, I definitely am not, I don't give up trying to be aware of what's going on, because if I'm in any other big city around the world, I'm careful about where I'm walking. I'm looking ahead and paying attention to things. Seattle is a big city. So, yeah, I've never stayed away from Seattle because I've been worried about my safety.
And I still continue to go downtown, but not as much as I used to. And I do have to say, like, when it gets dark, I worry even more. If I don't have to go downtown, I won't, or if I can find the same. I mean, I love the entertainment options that there are in downtown, but I do feel less safe. Well, yesterday we had an exclusive interview with King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg. Many critics are blaming him or his office for not being tough enough on these serial criminals, whether it's not charging them with serious enough crimes or asking for longer sentences. And we asked him about that repeat offender report, about the same 100 criminals being responsible for a majority of the crimes in downtown and 90% of them reoffending within months of getting out of jail. And one thing that I found out from our interview is that he said 10% of those cases actually involved his office because they were felonies.
Yeah.
And he said the rest were muni court cases.
They have a high volume of cases, and the misdemeanor courts are high volume courts, and so I don't know that they have an ability to necessarily enact the kinds of sentences that people wish they would. You know, with so much in the conversations I have with people, and this frustration is real, and it's legitimate. But a lot of times people express a desire about a justice system that they wish we had, and not the one that we actually have.
Yeah. And to most of the general public, they don't care about the distinction between a misdemeanor and a felony. They just care they want to feel safe downtown and bring their kids downtown and everything. So, I mean, in defense of what he's saying, he's talking about what he can do from his office.
Right.
But what struck me is that there seems to be opportunities to collaborate better because, it doesn't matter if it's a felony or misdemeanor. If you're scared by somebody either using drugs openly or selling drugs or doing something that seems violent and scary, right?
Right. And there is the sense, and I mentioned yesterday that every time I go downtown, I do see drug dealing.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's in the open.
It's so open.
Yep.
And so because he's also getting a lot of heat for his stance on, and he also clarified something, but his stance on decriminalizing drugs, at least low-level offenses.
And there's a bigger discussion about this, too, about this whole stop-and-frisk thing they're doing in New York for many years. It's now come under criticism with Michael Bloomberg's campaign for president. It's like, if you allow the sense that you can kind of get away with a certain amount of, you know, what's considered crime, then the other things start to increase as well, because it gives you that sense of nobody's in charge, nobody's paying attention, nobody's trying to stop the little things from happening that then possibly lead to the bigger feeling of kind of lawlessness, right?
Right?
Nobody wants that. That's bad for business. It's bad for everybody.
It is that broken windows theory.
Exactly. That's what it is. Yes.
Yeah. If you don't crack down on these smaller things, Then they just continue to accumulate.
But don't trample on people's civil liberties at the same time. It's a very, very delicate balance that I think is really hard to get right for the police and for the, you know, the court system too.
So. Right. But on the drug problem, he says they still do prosecute people who are dealing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, and he maintained that the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s was a failure. And this is what he had to say about that.
That's when crack cocaine started to come to town. And pretty soon we went from 400 cases a year to 4,000 drug cases a year. We built and filled prisons in the 90s. In fact, we tripled our prison population in Washington. It went from 6,000 to 18,000. And at some point in the 90s, more than a quarter of the people in prison were there for a drug offense. So we did that. And frankly, if prosecuting people who had a drug addiction worked, we wouldn't have a drug problem today, because we've done this tens and hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah, and a lot of it is demographics, about the way the population was different in the 90s, and there were more, you know, the baby boom generation, who we blame for lots of things. We blame them for the increase in crime and those kinds of things back then, but it seems more gray than that. Like, it's not either or. And
exactly,
the trick is,
and which was why what I was trying to tell him yesterday was, like, is there some kind of middle ground that you help the people that you can help and who really truly are those who are not trying to do harm onto others, but are really just harming themselves.
Yes. Simple solutions to complex problems are rarely work for very long. It might work for a little while, because nobody wants to crack. You know, remember the was 1980s with the Guardian Angels in New York City? That guy Curtis Sliwa, this guy's wearing the red berets, sort of citizens patrolling the streets because of the crime that was going crazy in New York in the 1970s and 1980s. I don't think we're here to that level here in Seattle yet, because people are looking to the different agencies.
Right.
That, again, the most general public does not appreciate the difference between Seattle and King County, Municipal Court, Superior Court. They just want to feel safe.
Right.
And until those different agencies can work together and at least articulate and try to persuade us why they're doing something, or that they are doing something productive and smart and positive, then everyone's going to just wonder and fear.
Right. Well, I think you said it exactly right. I will say that we are going to have the head of the Downtown Seattle Association coming up at 9:30, John Scholes. They've got a proposal now that will require some money, but they think that they have some ideas of how to make a dent in decreasing the number of violent crimes in downtown. We'll be hearing from him shortly. Right now, we're going to be doing our headlines of the morning, other headlines. For decades, it has been a felony charge to intentionally infect someone with HIV in Washington. But that could soon change under a bill in Olympia. And our intrepid reporter, Hannah Scott, is here to explain.
The bill would reduce the crime of intentional transmission of HIV from the current crime of assault, of felony assault, to a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor. Democratic Representative Nicole Macri says the change is long overdue and will finally treat HIV like what it is.
A treatable chronic illness, and not a moral failing or a criminal justice issue.
Unanimous opposition, though, from Republicans, who say this would make knowingly infecting somebody with HIV the same crime as stealing a candy bar. And Republican Rep. Michelle Collier says it has unintended consequences, because prosecutors often use this crime as a tool to go after rapists, because it's so hard to get a rape conviction in this state. She says removing that tool is a problem.
And what's going to happen to all those rape victims where they were able to prosecute this? And now we're going to reduce the sentence. We're going to let those rapists go free.
Man, so we were struggling with this one.
I mean, how much of it is symbolic? Or, I mean, how often is this statute used to prosecute somebody in Washington?
It's fairly rarely used. It was used in the 80s and 90s significantly in this state. And I think all of those cases, some that went to the state Supreme Court, actually were of people who were trying to hurt someone, did not care that they passed it to someone and they had it. They wanted to give it to everybody else, kind of a thing. More recently, I don't think it's been used as often. And the argument in support of this, too, is that there's a stigma. It creates this stigma. And overall across the nation, that it has led to people not being willing to get tested because they don't want to be able to be prosecuted under one of these laws, which were in multiple states, because they knew they had HIV and had sex with someone.
But if you are intentionally trying to harm someone by having sex with them, knowing that you have HIV or AIDS, that cannot be at the same level as stealing a candy bar.
Right. And there is still some prosecutorial discretion here, where there's other crimes that I think can be attached to that particular thing beyond assault, where, you know, attempted something else, a prosecutor could decide. It wouldn't be this crime, though.
It almost feels like they're wanting to change something that, if it were kept as is right now, you know, the great thing as far as HIV and AIDS is, you know, I remember when it first started, happening in
the 80s. Sentence. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It was a death sentence. Yep. And now you can live a long, productive life.
Normal life.
Very normal life, within which, you know, thank God.
Yeah.
But this idea of trying to say that, hey, you don't, that just makes no sense.
And again, there's some, the prosecutors would have some other tools to deal with that, because I think what was happening here over the last couple of decades is that a lot of people were getting caught up in this and charged with this, sentenced to decades in prison because they knowingly had sex with someone, even if that other person consented in some states or knew that that person had HIV, if they had sex without a condom, say. There's a lot of different examples of that happening. Our law was particularly vague, so there was a possibility of you getting prosecuted under this, which again, in turn, led to people not wanting to get tested. And when that happens, you unintentionally spread the illness because people don't know if they are HIV positive.
But it sounds like they're trying to create or change a law that, if applied with sense, really wouldn't
common
need
sense.
To be.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to go for 25 years for someone who had no idea this was going to happen. Right? I mean, it's like trying to create a law or change something that really is dealing with only the extremes.
Yeah. And the pros are that it's like we're trying to make the law catch up to how the technology and the actual health condition has changed based on the treatments they have now available.
Yeah. And look, there's Nicole Macri, the sponsor of this bill, said she had people in constituents that want her to go even further. This is like a compromise because there is a giant push to decriminalize HIV altogether.
And just to be clear, when we say decriminalize HIV, it's not a crime to have HIV or AIDS.
But is it a crime to have sex with someone when you do have it?
Well, if you don't, well, and that brings
up
another thing.
If there's malice, if you're doing it maliciously, right?
Or should you be required? Well, that's another question. Should you be required? So let's say we start dating. If I know that I have HIV or AIDS, should I be required to tell you that? I would think the answer is yes.
Yes.
Well, what about other conditions like herpes that are also sexually transmitted that there's no treatment for?
And I believe there were some
people should stop having
sex.
I think people should just stop having sex.
No, but see, again, you're going to the extreme. Okay. There's a difference between herpes and AIDS.
Well, but AIDS is what used to be a death sentence. It used to be fatal no matter what. Herpes is still, a life sentence, right? You can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get rid of HIV either.
Yeah,
you're going to live with that your entire life.
Yeah, it's a chronic condition you'll be taking medicine for and doing all sorts of stuff for.
First things first. Yeah. Here's something that you should always do, and we were talking about this too. Does this take the romance out when you're when you first start dating somebody? Okay, I mean, I've been out of the dating world for a while, but if you start dating somebody, why don't you say before we get sexually active? And I know more and more people are doing this.
Yeah,
let's take an STD test together.
That's it's a good practice. I think others would argue it's a mood killer, you know.
How often does that happen? You know what's an even bigger mood killer?
Yeah, exactly.
I totally agree.
I guess it depends on what your schedule is on that particular evening or day or whatever you're having a conversation or how eager you are to take it to the next level, I guess.
It's great in practice. Look, the bottom line is not everyone is sexually responsible, right? People have one-night stands. People are having unprotected sex.
Yeah.
This is about reducing the stigma of having HIV. And
I'm all for reducing the stigma, but I'm also not for now making it so that other people are in danger. I mean, that's just it. Well, we'll certainly hear a lot more about this. Thank you, Hannah. I appreciate it.
I like when we talk about $30 car tabs. So much, it's so much less personal.
Right. Okay, there is a case in Connecticut that is getting a lot of attention this morning. Three high school runners are suing to block transgender athletes from taking part in girls' sports. The three argue that competing against biologically male athletes has denied them the chance to win medals and get scholarship opportunities. So this lawsuit says this new policy, which allows high school athletes in competitions that align with their gender identity, is a threat to Title IX's protections against sex-based discrimination. And apparently all three of these athletes have competed and have almost always placed behind two really good sprinters who have won 15 girls state indoor championship races since 2017.
Yeah, and these the two girls who have won, I think were born biologically male but identify female, and they're at some point in their transition. We don't know how far along. We're getting to the really tough topics right off the bat here this morning.
I know.
No puppy dogs or anything like that. It's all just the hard stuff. This is a really interesting thing because I struggle with this because I know I'm old now because I see people talking about, I'm this gender and I like here's my pronouns, he, his. And part of me thinks like, oh, come on, do we really need to do that? But part of me also thinks like, oh, good, we're making progress. People who traditionally were just not even noticed or recognized or paid any attention to for how they felt about who they were now have a way to actually assert who they are, and they're not criticized for it or they're not punished for it. So that's good. But it still sort of feels like we're in this cutting edge of territory figuring out how we deal with cases like this where someone's gender identity and their statement of such means that other people who their gender identity means that they place second, third, or fourth in these running races, that if they weren't competing against someone who was male, who was born male, they might win and get a scholarship or something or get some other kind of reward. And now that's being taken away from them because of one person asserting their identity.
Yeah. And a couple of days ago, G and I were talking about, you know, what would you do if your child came out and said, I'm not a boy, you know, as I was born, but I'm a girl.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had that whole conversation. And I do struggle, you know, as far as this athletic part, which is, I mean, there is an advantage. There is an advantage if you are biologically male.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and you can't look at the evidence and say that's not the case. But I also support someone living their true self.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So in this case, Andrew, I thought Andrew came up with something. I thought, well, maybe that would be a good compromise.
Well, it just seems to me that, like, when you have teenagers who are not fully transitioned, or they're probably not on the hormones even yet, they might be a little bit, but still their body is, what, 90% male. They still have all the musculature, etc. Okay, just, you can be who you want to be. That's fine. You can even use the girls' bathroom if you'd like. You can identify as female, but just compete with the boys. I mean, there's boys competing with girls in wrestling, girls competing with boys. There's girls on the football teams, etc. But when it comes to a sport like track, I mean, it is a distinct disadvantage for someone whose body is 90% biologically male to be competing against girls, or just don't compete.
But if you identify as a girl, even though you were born a boy and biologically were a boy, and you have to run with the boys, that's sort of that. How would that make you feel?
Well, I can tell you, one of the seniors who is subject of this lawsuit says, I've faced discrimination in every aspect of my life. I no longer want to remain silent. I am a girl. I am a runner. I participate in athletics just like my peers to excel, find community and meaning in my life. It's both unfair and painful that my victories have to be attacked and my hard work ignored.
See, and that makes me sad, because no, I don't want anyone to feel that way, right? There's got to be some sort of a middle ground that doesn't actually, and maybe there's not, or if there isn't a middle ground, we have to just be able to accept that, okay, you're going to come in second or third place because these two girls run faster than you do. Is it really the end of the world if somebody wins a running race? I guess if it means no scholarship or something, yes, it's the end of the world.
That's it. Okay. Yeah. I mean, for some people, it's like, oh, it's not leveling the playing field.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of tough topics today.
I can't say I have a good answer, but it's something that is certainly going to continue to come up again and again. Well, coming up on the G and Ursula Show, we are going to be talking to the president of the Downtown Seattle Association. They do have a new plan that they think will help fight crime in the downtown core. You're listening to the G and Ursula Show. It is 9:33. Thank you for hanging out with us this morning on the G and Ursula Show. G is out. Felix is co-piloting with me. And this hour of our show is brought to you by Toyota of Puyallup. And Felix, we're continuing our conversation about what many would say is the deteriorating state of Seattle. Mayor Jenny Durkan now says she wants crime and violence in the city's downtown core to end for good.
Chief Bess and I are absolutely committed to make sure that this is not what we've seen before, a short-term fix, something where it disappears after the next moment arrives.
Durkan was speaking to the Downtown Seattle Association yesterday at their annual meeting. She promised to work with prosecutors and police to stop the cycle of violent repeat offenders. And joining us now on the G and Ursula Show is the president of the Downtown Seattle Association, John Scholes. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So you guys released a report yesterday about crime in downtown Seattle. What did it entail?
I spoke to the real significant and, I think, serious issue and challenge we have around public safety in the core of our downtown, and the fact that over the last 3 years we've seen an alarming 30% increase in violent crime in the area between I-5, the waterfront, Olive Way to the north, and Yesler Way to the south. So the real core of downtown, the heart of our city, we're going in the wrong direction when it comes to violent crime in particular. And while crime stats and the crime rate citywide are relatively flat over the last year, in the heart of our city, where so many live, work, shop, and play, we're going in the wrong direction, and that's unacceptable in our minds, and we need an action strategy to change course here, and we need to move with a real sense of urgency.
And if we were to go into the reasons why this is happening, it is so complex. I mean, just in the amount of time that we've been on the air with this show, we are trying to talk to basically every stakeholder, anyone who can have an influence on what is happening, and it's very complex. What, with your report and what you have found, is there someone or some agency or some, I mean, what do you blame? Who do you blame?
Our criminal justice system today is failing our community, and it's dysfunctional. And we have people that routinely hurt other people in the heart of our city that are not getting the help that they need, and they're not being held accountable for their behavior. And for too long, for going on three decades, we've had a deeply rooted and entrenched drug market in the heart of Seattle, and it's the worst kept secret in Seattle. And the center of that has been at Third and Pine, and it's been there for 20 plus years, and it fuels shoplifting and fencing of stolen goods and assaults and other violent crimes. And far too often there's innocent people that get caught up in the middle of that, which is what we saw last month with the tragic shooting at rush hour right in the middle of town. And we have to call this problem what it is. We can't sugarcoat the reality. We have to acknowledge that this is a deeply rooted drug market, and we need to do everything we can to break it up and to hold accountable the folks that are responsible for dealing drugs and committing violence against others in this part of our city. So, Third Avenue and Third and Pine is the lobby of Seattle. It's really the lobby of our city. It's where so many pass through. Arts and cultural institutions, our great civic institutions like the market, lots of people live, work, great small businesses. It's our retail core. It ought to feel the best and feel safe and welcoming for everybody.
Now, Seattle's a smart city, known for its innovative approaches to all kinds of things. And so why is it that the criminal justice system is failing like this?
I think we don't have a strategy. We don't have a strategy for how are we going to deal with people that are responsible for a significant amount of crime. The current practice has been they get arrested, they get booked, and then they're put back on the street. And so the baristas, the retail clerks, the security guards, they're really the ones now at the front lines of public safety every single day dealing with individuals coming in, committing assaults, stealing large amounts of goods, bringing them out on the sidewalk, and then they're part of an organized fencing operation that's fueling a drug market. And so we lack a clear strategy in our criminal justice system for what are we going to do with people that have a significant amount of criminal activity. The three individuals that ran around shooting guns at Third and Pine a month ago had dozens of arrests and convictions among them. And they'd been picked up in this part of town before. They were well known to Seattle police. They were well known to the retailers in the core of our downtown. They've been picked up with guns and previous felony convictions before in front of the McDonald's at Third and Pine. So what we're doing now is a complete and utter failure, and it's dysfunctional, it's expensive, it's putting the community at risk, it has a huge impact and cost for our retailers and small businesses. We have to change course.
John, you have proposed, or your group has proposed, something, a $40 million plan. Explain that.
We think, in addition to really significant reforms in the criminal justice system for how we're dealing with individuals who continue to commit crime, that there's also a needed and significant opportunity here to just improve the physical environment around Third and Pine, along Third Avenue, and along Pike and Pine. They're the busiest streets in our downtown, the most heavily traveled. It's the center of our transit system, 50,000 people getting on a bus and off a bus every day on Third Avenue. And the physical environment can be improved. And we put forward two visions, one for Third Avenue to really remake that street into a much more pleasant, enjoyable experience, wider sidewalks, better lighting, better signage, better landscaping, a much more delightful experience, one that we don't avoid as many do today. And then similarly for Pike and Pine Streets, our two great retail streets that connect the Pike Place Market all the way to the convention center and up to Capitol Hill to make a $40 million investment in enhancing the character of those two streets. Same types of investments of better lighting, signage, wayfinding, flowers, plantings, landscaping. These are two visions that we think are really important to ensure downtown is more walkable, interesting, delightful, and safe. In and of themselves, those investments will not appropriately address the real safety challenges we face. We must make reforms to the criminal justice system, but we think upgrading the lobby of our city, if you will, should be a part of our strategy.
Yeah, and those things will be great regardless of the crime and everything. That's everybody likes to see downtown Seattle improved and you know, nicer place to be and more functional. But in terms of like the immediate aftermath of the shooting and the death in the core of downtown a month ago, I mean, who of the different agencies, well, who's not doing their job or who could be doing a better job either working with their counterparts at these the differences between the municipal court and the superior court and the police and everything? It seems like there's a lot of players, but it's unclear who the one agency or one person is who can really take account and say it's going to be different and this is how it's going to be different and this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, there are a lot of players between the city and the county and the different branches of government, between the judicial branch and the executive and legislative and the county prosecutor and city attorney. Mm-hmm. And our message is, let's put the finger pointing down.
There
we
you
all
go.
Have a role to play here, and we need to come together on a collective strategy that's really focused on this part of town, because there's a unique set of conditions here that are not at play in other parts of the city. As I mentioned, the crime rate citywide has been relatively flat. In this part of town, it's dramatically gone in the wrong direction over the last 3 years. So we need to acknowledge that and really focus in on this problem, this part of town. All the academic research suggests that a majority of crime in a city occurs on a minority of block faces in the city. And in Seattle, a lot of our crime is occurring on the most populated part of our city, and is heavily concentrated around Third Avenue. So all the branches of government, all the elected officials and appointed officials that have responsibility for upholding our city charter, and the first paragraph of that is all about the health and welfare and safety of our community, all of them have a role to play here and need to be at the table in developing a very specific, immediate, bold strategy that can be sustained. And our measurements of success are going to be, are crimes against people in this part of town going up or down, and are fewer people being put in and back out in our criminal justice system? Are we reducing recidivism among individuals that have historically committed crimes in this part of our city? We should look at those two measures of success 6 months from now, a year from now, and judge whether the efforts are effective or not.
Yeah. John, we're talking about, this is the dismal backdrop that we're dealing with, but there's also good things happening in downtown, and that was part of your report.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's what I think makes this safety issue so significant, is that we have a lot at risk here. We've had this incredible 20-year run in downtown Seattle. I described it yesterday as sort of we've been in beast mode as a downtown. You know, record amounts of investment in, you know, job growth and residents moving in and lots more retail. We've got, you know, a new arena coming, a new waterfront, a new convention center. Seattle's been hot and in demand. We've got a great downtown, and we've got great fundamentals. And as we look forward to the next decade, we've got a really strong foothold. But all of that is at risk if we don't take some urgent action here to deal with the real safety issues in the heart of our downtown. And all those companies, the residents, the visitors, the small business owners, the folks who love arts downtown, they don't have to be here. At the end of the day, they do not have to be here. They have choices within the region and around the country. And we got to do everything we can to keep them and attract others. And everybody deserves to be safe and feel welcomed in our downtown, whether you're coming from Issaquah, whether you live downtown, you're visiting from Istanbul, you're here for a convention, you're working as a barista in a coffee shop. You deserve to feel and be safe.
Thank you. That is John Scholes, the president of the Downtown Seattle Association. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again many more times on the G and Ursula Show. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
And you didn't mention the Bon Marché star being saved as part of the great run of downtown. So
that is near and dear to Felix's heart. Thank you, John. Coming up next, Felix Bonnell is going to be the star of the show. We're going to dive inside the strange and wonderful world of local North Seattle history.
Ooh. Stay tuned.
This is the G and Ursula Show. We sure do appreciate you listening this morning. And I'm enjoying my time here with our resident historian, Felix Bendel, who you just get to find out so many different things about our region. And now you're going to delve into North Seattle.
Yeah, I do this weekly feature Friday mornings on Seattle's Morning News at about 6:35. It's called All Over the Map. We look into the sort of the stories behind the names of local places. And I take that definition pretty broadly, because it was 72 years ago this week that the plans for a revolutionary new shopping center in Seattle were announced. But where did the name Northgate actually come from? And you know, Northgate, I don't know if you've been to Northgate lately. I
mean, yes.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was there last night. It's two separate malls. It's all under construction. They've torn down the old Bon Marché that was built almost 70 years ago. And there's big plans in the future. There's a light rail station that's going to open. The hockey team, whatever they're called, is going to be having a practice facility and a public skating rink there. So there's big things ahead in the future, and there's still businesses open there. There's restaurants. And it was reminding me of the mall from Stranger Things. Did you ever see season two of Stranger Things? There was a mall that figured prominent, and that's what it felt like last night at Northgate to me. But that name Northgate, for the shopping center, for the street, for that neighborhood, the value of it, you know, the location might seem pretty obvious now, but in February 1948, when it was announced, there was no Interstate 5. A Roosevelt Way, it was two blocks to the east, you know, was a thoroughfare. But Highway 99, the main road in and out of Seattle in those days, is a mile and a half to the west. Even the city limits were 25 blocks south. That part of what's now Northgate wouldn't become Seattle until 1954. So it wasn't quite the boonies, but it was definitely the outskirts of town. And it was right after World War II, it was a shopping center built for people to come by car. And one of the cool things, in the old part of the mall, there's still a hallway with all these historic photos. It's like this little kind of out-of-the-way, bizarre little museum. And there are these fabulous aerial shots that show these buildings just surrounded by thousands of cars. It's just a huge parking lot with buildings in the middle. It's very different than the kind of stuff we talk about with downtown Seattle now.
Right,
and the suburban
right.
It's very different. But it was groundbreaking at the time. And so the guy who developed it was named Jim Douglas. He died in 2005 at age 95. He did all this stuff in Seattle in the second half of the 20th century. But he built that whole Northgate development. His cousin is political analyst C.R. Douglas. He used to be on Twitter, and he's an old friend of mine. I worked with him at the Seattle Channel. Reached out to C.R. to ask him, did Jim come up with the name Northgate? And C.R. doesn't think so, because he heard all the stories from his cousin about that. They had the world's tallest Christmas tree on display at Northgate back in Christmas 1950, 212 feet tall. But C.R.'s guess is that Allied Stores, which owned the Bon Marché in those days, and that was a big deal. If you see the pictures, the Bon Marché is this huge building, now since torn down, by the way. Anyway, he thinks they came up with the name. And you look at the old newspaper archives from 1948, and they credit a guy named Ben Ehrlichman, who's actually uncle of Watergate figure John Ehrlichman.
Really?
And if I was really clever, I'd be able to say from Northgate to Watergate, but it's not really. That'd be kind of overstepping a little bit. But the Seattle Times said that Ehrlichman named the development Northgate because it's the most important northerly business district serving Seattle and vicinity and the gateway to metropolitan Seattle. I'm not positive that Ehrlichman was the guy who came up with it, but he gets credited by the Seattle Times for doing it. My favorite factoid about this whole story. So Jim Douglas developed Northgate. That's where the hockey team's going to practice.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Douglas's dad, J.F. Douglas, developed the Metropolitan Tract in downtown Seattle, including the hockey rink built in 1915 by the Metropolitan Building Company, from which our hockey team, the Metropolitans, got their name and where they won the Stanley Cup in 1917. So the new team, whatever it's called, will be playing in a development that the son of the guy who developed the original place for the original team developed. So there's this weird DNA connection between...
Wow.
Our original hockey team 100 years ago, and the new one coming up next year.
Wow. Well, thank you. Learn something new every day. Thank you, Felix. Coming up, our Ask Me Anything segment, and you're listening to the G and Ursula Show.